Okay, we'll call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. This is Chair Culver. And with us today, we have Rep. Vasquez, co-chair, and Representative Clayman, Tallico, Tilton, and Wool. So, the only one missing is our honorable member from District 40. Today's agenda, we have an overview presentation by Nils Anderson, Executive Director, Institute of the North, on lessons learned from the Arctic Energy Summit. And then we're going to have a bill hearing and bill presentation on HJR 8. Feds allow the state to make energy choices. And that will be presented by Representative Tallico, sponsor, and we'll have public testimony and testimony from the Legislative Information Offices. And then we'll hold that bill and hold the public hearing open to be continued, scheduled next week. So, is there anything else to add on the agenda, Madam Co-Chair?
Mr. Co-Chair, I believe the bill would be rescheduled for the 17th of February. This will provide ample opportunities for other parties that may want to comment.
Okay, with that, we'll go to Nils Anderson offline there, and his PowerPoint will be presented here in the committee room. Mr. Anderson.
Yes, thank you, co-chairs, members of House Energy. For the record, my name is Nils Andreasen. I'm the Executive Director of the Institute of the North. And this morning, I want to really just review our understanding of the Arctic energy issues based on policy tours that we've conducted as well as Arctic energy summits that we've hosted. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Iceland and Norway, do a quick review of how communities in other locations do it, and then talk a little bit about how we've approached the Arctic Energy Summit and how we're planning for a 2015 event. So the Institute of the North is the Center for Alaska's Arctic Policy. Next slide. Our vision is that effective land and resource governance results in individual and collective prosperity. And you'll see, sense in this our founder's vision, Governor Hickel, his understanding of the owner state, and firm belief that with proper responsible state management of land and resources, that the people would benefit. Our mission is to inform public policy and cultivate and engage citizenry. I really focused in this on understanding and conveying the opportunities and obligations of the Arctic. And related to this mission, the way we do this is to convene different groups and forums at the intersection of public sector, industry, and the private sector, and community leaders. Next slide. The Institute recognizes that there are fundamental challenges facing Alaska and Alaska's Arctic. You know, I know about declining oil production and price. In the Arctic, we face a fairly significant infrastructure deficit. At the same time, increasing change is taking place and increasing activity is occurring. We have a state and national environment of fiscal constraints, and that's something actually we see in many of the eight Arctic nations, a similar challenge. We also have increasing international and national attention. At the same time, we have local and regional areas of concern. And a huge disconnect between local concerns, state concerns, and national attitudes. I think this is something that members of this committee recognize well. Next slide. So I want to talk here's a quick review of fundamental lessons for Alaska from our policy tours to Iceland and Norway. Iceland's a little bit more relevant in what I'll talk about because when it comes to Norway, we're talking oil and gas issues, but I'll review both. Before I get into details, some takeaways for you from both locations. In Iceland, four lessons for us. One, they chose a resource that they had a competitive advantage in, geothermal, and they coupled that with hydro. But very focused on these are the resources that are most important to us. Second, they spent 10 years developing a comprehensive plan on how to develop that resource. Third, the state government, the national government, owns the infrastructure. They've left it to communities and companies to develop the actual resource and do the project side of things, but the grid is owned by the state power company in the state. The fourth lesson is that based on this infrastructure in place, they have the ability to see investment in and export value-added product. So their main industry is energy-intensive industry. In Norway, a different model, a focus on exporting non-renewable resources, oil and gas, while developing renewables for domestic use. So everything that's oil and gas, they send elsewhere, while developing hydro and other renewables for domestic energy. They co-invest in oil and gas production, exploration, as well as infrastructure, sharing both in risk and reward, and they've built the regulatory capacity for effective and efficient development of resources. I have oil and gas in these slides to some extent because I think there are good examples of how we can approach energy as a state more broadly. Next slide. Iceland and Alaska, by the numbers, significantly different jurisdictions. The entire population of Iceland would fit in the Anchorage and Matsu region, a very small area that Iceland has to deal with compared to a very large state, and so on. We will see that installed electricity generating capacity is similar, but power consumption is hugely different, and that's a result of the energy-intensive industry that they have built up, really around hydro and some around geothermal. A different energy portfolio, and I'm not suggesting that we need a different energy portfolio. Really, my takeaway is that they've focused on one or two that they've got a significant resource in and become experts at it. And I think Alaska has the opportunity to do the same, and actually specifically with natural gas. Next slide. So Iceland energy mix is 80% of its primary energy supply comes from renewables, from hydro and geothermal, those meeting 99.9% of electricity production and 99% base heating. The remaining 20% of their energy portfolio comes from imported fossil fuels, used mainly transportation and fisheries. And we've heard from President Grimson of Iceland that one of their goals is to continue transitioning away from imported fossil fuels toward more renewable sources for transportation and fisheries use. Next slide. The electricity profile, and this is back in 2010, is interesting, especially when you look at the consumption side of things. 73% of their electricity goes to support the aluminum industry. So this is the energy-intensive industry that they've developed and the value added that they can provide based on their resources. Iceland doesn't have aluminum as a resource, but this is shipped up from Brazil, actually, and the smelters in Iceland convert it and send it off to markets. And economics are fairly significant when it comes to this industry. The hydro developed to support the aluminum industry is providing 2 cent, 3 cent kilowatt hour power for these energy intensive industries, and you can see the result of that is attracting industry to Iceland, and it contributes to a large portion of their GDP. Next slide. I mentioned hydro. This is the Kernuker hydropower plant, actually fairly similar in size and design to that proposed at Watana Susitna. And the Institute of the North was able to visit this location during its Iceland policy tour and learn more about it. And certainly we can share this, more information about this, or provide experts who can answer questions about it as you like. Next slide. This is a Fjarlal aluminum smelter, an example of one of the smelters in Iceland. I believe it's this location or a very similar one that's connected almost directly to the Kernuker power hydro plant, with the transmission line that provides almost the entire power portfolio for this smelter. So what they've done is connect their energy resource to an industry that's contributing to their GDP and having significant results. Some of the leftover remaining power from the hydro plant does go back into the energy grid that circumvents the entire Iceland, the nation, but it's a very small proportion. Next slide. Here we've got Iceland's exports, and you can see that these EII's, energy-intensive industries, make up a quarter of their trade. And I'd say another quarter is fisheries, another quarter is tourism, and then everything else. So a four-legged stool for Iceland, with 25% of that, the value added to the energy-intensive industries. Next slide. I mentioned earlier the comprehensive planning that Iceland's gone through, and what they've done is really focus double down on renewable energy sources replacing imported energy. When they did, it was municipalities that drove this process from imported fossil fuels to geothermal and then hydro, and local utilities that made the transition. So it wasn't state-led in that sense, but the state got on board pretty quickly. Anecdotally, we heard consumers who had been paying from the transition, what they were paying in a month, they were now paying in a year. So a huge difference in consumers' lives, and they used this to step up and off into economic development. Around that renewable energy, supported a diverse industry with some of their geothermal power plants having 18 different value streams, value added from fish to aquaculture to medical, biochemical project, biomedical products. In general, they've taken a protective approach to energy production, and you can see this in their master plan for the utilization of renewable energy resources, led by the University of Iceland in partnership with the government. They spent 10 years reviewing 80 different possibilities for hydro and geothermal power plants around the nation, evaluating them in a pretty complex process, looking at sustainability, preservation of natural environments, regional development and economy, and then splitting those resources out into three categories, from green to yellow to red, whether they wanted to proceed with the utilization, they needed further research, or that they decided the resource should be preserved and not utilized for energy purposes. So automatically, they've got a third of their energy resources that they've said we should we shall develop this for the really the maximum benefit of our people, for the public interest. And what we've seen, how they've decided which projects to approach, it's really they've looked at communities or regions of Iceland in need and invested nearby so that they could have industry that supports the local economy and can sustain social services like education and healthcare, etc. This plan, I don't think, has been ratified by Iceland's parliament, but is in front of them for further discussion. But it's I think it's a fundamental piece of how Iceland's approached their energy. Beyond a policy, they've really categorized their energy resources and been strategic in how they deliver them. Next slide. I mentioned the grid earlier. Again, there's a circumferential grid around Iceland that serves almost all communities, and there is one portion of Iceland in the northwest that is off-grid and depends on diesel. Actually, it's those communities are subsidized by the government, much like our PCE communities. But the rest of the nation pays between 8 and 11 cent kilowatt hour. And the grid was originally developed by the private sector. The government of Iceland took it over and has guaranteed, basically, power to it, to its citizenry, and leaving it up to utilities then to provide takeoff points and do the end, deliver power to the end user. And what they've said is that the access to the transmission system guaranteed by the government creates a framework so that competition can occur. Next slide. So I think the lessons for Alaska from Iceland for us has been we met with their Minister of Finance and in many discussions. There's been a focus on fiscal prudence, especially since the collapse of their banks. A fundamental lesson was spend less than you earn. And I think we've actually seen this apply in many aspects of Icelandic society. They're careful in how they approach big projects, and big projects are only pursued when financing or a buyer is in place. And for big projects or projects of any kind, the government only acts as the guarantor and not the financier. Again, Iceland's looked at long-term decision-making when it comes to infrastructure investment. And there's been a fairly cohesive society that's been willing to sacrifice in the short term for future prosperity. Icelanders have made this upfront decision that with state investment in infrastructure and providing fundamental building blocks of socio and economic development, that in the future, Iceland consumers and citizens will benefit positively. When it comes to strategic planning, I think that Iceland can be very intentional about what it takes to develop a resource and see progress toward developing essential expertise. Iceland currently runs a UN program on geothermal and, you know, basically serves the entire world in training people to how to develop their geothermal resource. I know that the Alaska Center for Energy and Power is looking to develop a similar program here in Alaska, focus on wind diesel, where an aspect of energy that Alaska is a leader in. But they're exporting that expertise and benefiting for it. Iceland does have a fairly straightforward economic development strategy, and included in that is a diversification of national economic portfolio with cluster development. For those of you who've been following some of the work of Juno Economic Development Corporation or the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, or FEDC, up in Fairbanks. There's been some good work around clusters in the state that could be further supported. Finally, Iceland's master plan for energy development has given them a green light in moving forward. And they having already weighed all the options, they've got clarity when it comes to making decisions. So there's not as much back and forth, there's no litigation, there's been a process in place that's solved for a lot of that already. And that's really what we've learned then from Iceland. I'm going to move now to Norway. Sorry, next slide. Should read snapshot of Norway. You could see, I think what I've heard most often after our Norway policy tour was that we've been comparing apples to oranges, and certainly we understand that Norway is very different than Alaska. A larger population, a larger income per capita, larger GDP than the U.S., relatively small unemployment rate, but a very different social contract with its people. It's a very high taxation. It's a nation and not a state. It's approached its delivery of services very differently. But I do think that some of the processes that Norway's gone through are worth evaluating here in Alaska. Next slide. I'm going to talk just a little bit about Norway's licensing system, and then comment more broadly on their energy portfolio domestically. Norway's licensing system, Norway selects tracks to license for a six-year initial term after consulting with stakeholders, community leaders, fishing interests, and labor, as well as with the private sector and industry. The Norwegian government has a very good relationship with industry, so that it's able to identify tracks to license that would be most valuable. And that value is determined, or helped determine, by Norway's conducting of the initial seismic 2D results that are made public. Industry, instead of a bonus bid and royalty, industry submits an application consisting of a work plan that includes a company's financial strength and safety record, and licenses are awarded through the Norwegian Petroleum Directorate based upon that work plan. Basically, whichever company or groups of companies can extract the most value from a tract is awarded a license, and the Norwegian Petroleum Directorate puts together the right grouping of companies to make sure that happens. I mentioned 6 years, and there's a drill or drop provision in that license that they've got 6 years to get to production. Next slide. All the environmental and other approvals are included in the license, so it's a fairly streamlined process. They don't have as many of the regulatory hurdles from different jurisdictions that we do here in the U.S. or in Alaska. The Norwegian Petroleum Directorate really is a one-stop shop for moving forward. As part of its decision in who to include in licenses, the NPD often has the state-directed financial instrument, SDFI, basically a state-owned investment company called Totoro, that shares as part of the term. So the state-owned investment firm contributes upfront capital, participates as a partner, has access to the information, and shares in the risk and reward. That also means that all the private industry and that the Petoro, the state, is at the table in the decision-making process, sharing the investment, expenses, and information. Next slide. Just a little bit more about SDFI. The state invests and participates directly in the development of the resource. It's the private industry that does actual development, but the SDFI is does a co-investment as a partner. The state substitutes definitive work and investment commitments for upfront lease bonus, so they don't take, it's not who pays the most upfront, it's who can do the best work. The state also substitutes participation in development decisions and access to information for the passive royalty role. So again, they're a partner in this process, an active participant rather than driving from the back seat. Next slide. The SDFI, what we've seen is that it creates alignment of interest between the state and the producers. The state's able to take more of its government share, Norway would argue, while the producers feel they have the stability in place to move forward. They have certainty, they have stability, they have co-investment, and they're guaranteed a rate of return that they're comfortable with. And the state gets from that an understanding of the investment dynamics, access to the data, the ability to help drive development decisions. And I think beyond that, it really increases the state's understanding of oil and gas process and reduces state suspicion. Again, Norway once used the bonus and royalty system but transitioned away from it because they had concluded that it impaired investment decisions. Next slide. We recognize that implementing SDFI in Alaska would be challenging, not, I guess, to say the least, but it could be added as an option in new leases, and there's perhaps some low-hanging fruit that SDFI makes sense for. As part of this, having a professional, non-politicized corporation able to administer the state's interests would be beneficial. Next slide. Just to recap from some of what we learned in Norway, Norway reduced risk by providing the 2D seismic. They reduced upfront costs by not requiring bids for their tracks. They have shared risk and co-investment through their SDFI. They have alignment between the industry and the state. They have predictability, quick permitting, and a license to production in 3 years. And they have tax stability, a high tax that's non-progressive with pretty significant deductibility of development costs. And I know that House Energy doesn't necessarily tackle oil and gas issues, but I think a lot of these lessons are important for domestic energy and how we approach energy resources in general. So hopefully this is of value to you. Next slide. Takeaways from Norway. Again, the Norwegian Petroleum Directorate, which serves as kind of a cross between DNR and AEA, is really an intersection of the public and private sector with the public interest. And as part of the NPD, you see the national government, industry, and labor unions providing those three perspectives and making decisions. Norway uses its oil and gas for export and develops renewables, mostly hydro, and it's had hydro in place for a century, but its renewables are for domestic energy consumption. Government's take has been maximized through state-owned enterprise, through its co-investment arm, and state investment in infrastructure. It actually invests quite a bit in pipelines and transmission lines, etc., through its many state either corporations or agencies. And ultimately, the stability plus the returns result in private sector confidence. Norway is experimenting with other approaches to domestic energy use. Norway is, all of its communities are on the grid or otherwise subsidized by government for basically a postage stamp rate when it comes to power. And that grid connectivity for their communities has really made a huge difference on their social well-being and standard of living. And I can send, after this presentation, some research we did on the impact of grid connectivity in Norway, in Alaska, in Iceland, in Chukotka, and Canada, that I think kind of proves that point. And I know that Alaska is wrestling right now with its grid along the rail belt, as well as lack of grid in rural communities. Next slide. So I think, you know, our lessons in general from our work in all eight Arctic nations and in thinking about Iceland and Norway, I think in reflection I've seen very effective criteria developed by governments and the ability to judge or decide a project based on very specific merits. And I think this is an area that House Energy could really explore further, basically developing a roadmap from that utilizes clear criteria, implements a strategy that moves from the current energy policy to an implementation plan, and then developing a system that's able to track projects and expenditures. And it seems like the goal that I've seen done well in other nations is that governments have a better ability by employing these three aspects to determine how to move forward, how to make decisions when it comes to energy, being able to prioritize projects and rank them according to return on investment has been a significant portion of how other nations have approached this. And I think in an environment of fiscal constraint, something like this is actually low-hanging fruit. Having a roadmap developed that moves from policy to implementation on a statewide basis isn't resource-intensive, but something that House Energy, the legislature, working in concert with state agencies, could actually see move forward. Next slide. Some potential recommendations based on this review and actually from an Alaska dialogue that we had hosted around energy policy in the state, really a sense that we needed to consolidate oversight. We've seen in other nations a one-stop shop or something similar to a clearinghouse, the ability to oversee projects, make sure they're providing the right return on state investment, and actually delivering on commitments to improving standard of living in communities. And I don't know if making standing committees of House Energy instead of in-state energy would help with that, or other ways to move this forward. But I do think, based on looking at how other nations have done it, that the state of Alaska and the legislature could approach domestic energy in a very different way. And with that, I think we need the ability to evaluate energy projects better, and perhaps instead of projects or technology, focusing on infrastructure. What we've seen in all eight nations is the state or nation investing most in the basic infrastructure needed to deliver energy to citizens. And that's certainly something that House Energy could take up. We do need to encourage better outreach and communication from state agencies and to better understand their benchmarks of success. And I encourage House Energy to consider that as one way to understand what's going on in the state and review it and rank it according to the state's and public interest. We should be looking, especially in today's fiscal environment, at private investment and getting out of the way as much as possible to support that investment, even as we leverage state resources around access and infrastructure. Perhaps, finally, implementing some sort of energy strategy, I would say, as a key element of fiscal policy that would give best posts for policymakers and agencies. It seems that in our current energy policy, the state wants to be a leader in all things, and by really prioritizing having a better understanding of how decisions connect back to an overall state fiscal policy, policymakers and state agencies could move forward in lockstep for mutual benefit of Alaskans.
Mr. Anderson?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Chair Colbert. If we could wrap up in 5 minutes, otherwise I'm going to have to take a break and take up a bill and then come back to you. So if we could wrap up in five and then give the committee about 5 minutes for questions, is that possible?
Yep, I can wrap up in 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's really most of what I wanted to say. Next slide. We did host an Arctic Energy Summit in 2013 with themes of richness, responsibility, and resilience. Next slide. It was a cross-sectoral approach, really understanding that the private sector will lead when it comes to energy development. The public sector will respond, regulate, and manage that activity, and both will depend on academia and non-governmental organizations to move projects forward. Next slide. We defined richness as renewables, non-renewables, and efficiency and conservation. Often efficiency and conservation is left out of that mix. Next slide. When it comes to responsibility, in all eight nations, we see a commitment to risk mitigation and a basic understanding that energy development is not risk-free. If nations have responsibility in place early, then we can help mitigate risk. Next slide. Resilience is the ability to respond and adapt to change or for a system to bounce back. So by implementing responsibility now in energy development, you see systems more resilient. Next slide. I mentioned these are recommended research and projects that came out of the 2013 Energy Summit. I mentioned the grid connectivity research that we've completed last year, and I'll send that to you. But really, in all eight nations, we need a better understanding of the measures of government support and how effective they are, how communities are benefiting from energy development, what policies promoting renewable energy are most effective, as well as financial vehicles to support energy development and guides to northern energy efficiency and conservation. Next slide. In September 20th through 30 this year in Fairbanks, we'll be hosting the 2015 Arctic Energy Summit, a theme of energy contributing to a lasting future, and sub-themes of security and affordability. This will really frame the entire three-day discussion. We'll report our outcomes to the Arctic Council's Sustainable Development Working Group, and there are three tracks related to oil and gas development, remote heat and power, and clean energy. And I would encourage House Energy members to, I hope you'll participate. I think to the extent that the Energy Summit can be a vehicle for your priorities, please do count on our support in moving them forward. Next slide. Finally, thank you to all the members. Sorry if I took more time than I should have, but really appreciated the opportunity to give this presentation and review some of our work in the Arctic.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Very informative. For the record, Representative Nagyak will join us at 10:22. If you could follow up on that energy summit in Fairbanks in September and get invitations to the Energy Committee, it would be most appreciated. And if there's issues that we want to highlight at your summit, perhaps we could hold a hearing there. I could talk with the chair and see if we might want to hold a hearing up there at that time on an issue that would be of Representative Nagyak.
Thank you. I had a few questions, but I think I'll just go right down to the point here.
Billy, could you put the mic down?
Since we don't have much time, I think we should. Where in Alaska can we research a system in a real project? Anybody? Neil?
Through the chair, Representative Nagyak. I think, you know, one of Alaska's best assets is the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and they do have the ability to do the research and test out on-the-ground projects and come away with a fairly sophisticated understanding of costs and benefits.
Follow?
Yeah, go ahead.
I recommend that this committee ask the chairs, co-chairs, to get this in motion, to talk to the people, as you said, to see what we can do to try something like this, to see if we can do it, see what we need to do and all that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, you're talking about implementation of the recommendations?
Right.
Okay, well, maybe that's something for the committee to look at down the road a little bit. Good comment. Anyone else in the committee had a question?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you. A couple questions. You said in Iceland the state owns the grid. What about in Norway?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf. I'm not sure. I don't think that it's state-owned, but I would have to check with that. I know that there's a state-owned, there's a state power company, Statkraft, that probably manages it. I'll follow up and get you an answer to that question.
Follow up, please.
Go ahead.
You said focus on infrastructure is a goal, not on the products or the technology. So I guess it's more about my first question. Also, the rate of return. What's the rate of return in Norway? You mentioned a 78% tax.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Wolf. In talking with Norway's Ministry of Finance, you know, they said that for the state's resources, optimally we would get 100% government take. Industry, we recognize that industry won't accept that. So what Norway's done is try to get as close to 100% if they can. The 70% tax is one piece of it. The co-investment is another piece of it. So they've really gone to extraordinary lengths to get as much back of a state resource as possible.
One more follow-up. Is Norway's production in oil and gas comparable to Alaska's?
To the chair, I'm not sure about its current rate of production, but can also get you that information easily enough. We have had a presenter from Norway address the state legislature before, Deputy Minister Ole Anders Linse, and I would be happy to connect him with this body, if you would like to explore more of how Norway is doing it.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to have to, we got to roll out a bill here. One final question, then if you'd hold on, Mr. Anderson, we'll come back to the committee after we hear the bill. I understand that you get, there's only one environmental suit allowed on a Norway project. And after that, there's no more challenges allowed. Do you have any information on that?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's right. They've gone to great lengths to minimize that kind of delay. And a lot of it occurs through in setting up the licensing. They've already done a lot of that negotiation. And then just the one lawsuit allowed after that. I think that's right.
Okay, thank you. We're going to have to.
Is he coming back?
We're going to gavel you out and put you back on. Set up for the next hearing. If you'd hang on, or we'll call back in about 15 minutes, and we're going to hear this bill, and we'll come back to you on the agenda.
10% by the year 2030.
Excuse me, Joshua, yes. Can you, for the record, read the title of the resolution, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The title is Urging the Federal Government to Empower the State to Protect the State's Access to Affordable and Reliable Electrical Generation.
Thank you. Proceed.
The EPA's Clean Power Plan will apply to all fossil fuel power plant generation. That includes coal, gas, oil, and NAFTA, which for plants that are greater than 25 megawatts, except for plants that are on the military bases in Alaska and the university. While well-intentioned, this plan will likely lead to much higher electricity costs, and there should be a study in your packet that indicates that nationwide we should be seeing as high as 37% increase in electrical costs. The Clean Power Plan is based on inaccurate assumptions that can have major effects on Alaska. The first assumption is that the largest source of carbon emissions is from power plants. While this may be the case in the lower 48 and the rest of America, power plants in Alaska only account for about 25% of carbon emissions. The remaining 75% of stationary source carbon comes from operations on the North Slope. We believe that the Clean Power Plan puts unrealistic expectation on Alaska's power plants. Another assumption is that low-cost natural gas and renewable energy sources are ready to use for major energy consumption. While this isn't available for the most part in South Central Alaska, this would not be feasible for the interior, at least in the near term. The EPA's claim that Alaskans will save on energy costs will not be realized for interior Alaska as long as natural gas is not available in Fairbanks. And even if it were available, at this point, projected costs would be $20 per million BTUs. But the fundamental purpose that we bring this resolution to the committee is to protect Alaska's sovereignty. The 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution states that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively and to the people, or to the people. Mr. Chair, I've read the Constitution a number of times, and I have not found in the enumerated powers of Congress or the executive branch that gives them the power to regulate carbon emissions in America. If the Constitution does not say that the federal government can regulate emissions, then that automatically means it's the state's responsibility. We believe that the state of Alaska has the means to make effective decisions that not only can deal with the problems arising from climate change, but do so in a way that doesn't hurt Alaskans. SGR 8 urges the federal government to leave decisions at the state level and the local level in regulating energy production in order to protect access to affordable and reliable electrical generation. And Mr. Chair, we have been discussing some possible changes to the resolution, and so this likely won't be the final version that the committee will see. So we've discussed this with some of the utilities as well as the members of the RCA to make some changes to it. And we're more than open to any other changes that the committee has. And with that, Mr. Chair, I can take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Banks. Representative Nagyak.
On our lowest production costs on line number 9 and 10, whereas the Regulatory Commission of Alaska should be empowered to make decisions with methodology based on the lowest production cost for electrical generation. I know there's two types of fuel that we're talking about: is coal-fired and natural gas, and that's rationale behind the bill is to get more coal generation. Is what I understand, right?
We'll punt that over to Rep. Tallarico on the intent of his bill, his resolution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't know that it's necessarily the intent to generate more coal-fired power, but at the very least to
maintain and hold on to what we have. But currently in the interior, that's the most affordable power that's provided to us. Although we have the intertie, and I think the committee will remember just the other day, we have power production available in other parts of the state. The bottleneck is the actual transmission lines in the intertie. So our most affordable power that we will have consistently in the interior are the existing coal-fired power plants. In fact, I didn't have this data with me, but just recently, because of that pancake effect that we talked about the other day with tariffs, right now fuel costs for coal-fired power in the interior with the utility that utilizes it at 4.9 cents per kilowatt hour. And for them to purchase hydropower, according to these figures, is 5.8 cents per kilowatt hour. So we can't even match that affordability with hydro right now that's available because of the pancake tariff rates by the time it gets delivered. And my biggest concern right now in the interior is the affordability of that at 23.5 cents a kilowatt hour. And a step beyond that, or beyond that utility's customers, it's really the hub for a bunch of our remote communities. And a lot of that additional cost, if we incur that, will be passed along to the remote communities to get their supplies and things. So really trying to preserve that, keep those costs down.
In relation to this, I know we were talking about power generation last year and how to reduce the cost of power generation in especially in rural Alaska by using grids. What was that?
Microgrids.
You know, because in most communities here, the several communities real close to each other. And I think Mira from ABEC last year made a recommendation, or not recommendation, but she talked about that. And I think that's an idea that we should consider because, you know, that would reduce the cost of energy in most of the villages that have horrendous energy costs. And I would like to have an explanation would benefit from 1.5% cap on electricity rate increases.
We'll give that to Representative Talrico to respond.
Thank you, and through the chair. That's one of the issues that we're working with some other agencies on, with members of the RCA and the utilities and everything. I guess my best description is I'm not married to anything in this. We are very open and looking for some assistance as we go forward. So I've actually asked the co-chairs to make sure and hold this so that we can gather more information and actually create a better document before we move it along. But that is one of the issues where I'm sure we'll have to make a change there. It's kind of a starting point for us, but it's always a dream of mine to keep energy costs as low as possible. But they do need more flexibility than that, I realize. So they'll be making recommendations to us that we can bring to the committee.
I'm sorry, but I hate to hug all this, but I have a couple
follow up, Representative Nagel.
And on the line 14 and 15, I'd like to have examples of closing coal-fired power plants, if there's any.
Okay, Representative Talrico, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we've gone through, Joshua and I have gone through, and I think we probably delivered to you electronically, the one EPA document that was produced by the EPA is about 300 pages long. So I don't expect anybody to have already read it fully to its extent, but the primary, my primary concern there is the carbon reduction seems to be focused on basically the power producing industry
at least the way I read it. That's my interpretation, though. That's not everyone else's interpretation, maybe, but it seems to be focused on that. And what we've found out is most of the carbon that we produce actually isn't from our power plants like it is in other areas of the nation. Ours is 25%, and 75% comes from somewhere else. And so our concern is if we shut those down, since these are our cheapest energy sources in the interior, and if that turns out to basically be a target, then what we'll be doing is adding to the cost of energy, but our carbon reduction won't be as impacted as it would be in other areas of the nation. So I'm probably one of those Alaskans that always thinks we're a special case, and no one will ever convince me we're not, because we live in a different area of the nation.
So all the people in the state are special.
All the people in the state are special. I agree.
Well, thank you, representatives. If we could just go to Mr. Banks, the presenter, just he wants to make clarify something.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to supplement Representative Tallarico's comments. In the study that we provided on page 23, the Energy Ventures analysis did a very thorough study of the Clean Power Plan. They've read through the entire 300 pages, probably multiple times, and they are looking at the U.S. generation capacity mix, 2012 versus 2020, and they are estimating that there'll be 20% generation provided by coal versus 31% in 2012. And so likely that would require closure of coal plants throughout the country.
I don't know how that's possible. Is it going to be in reducing? I don't think we should reduce power generation by coal. In our area, we have a potential of generating power with the cleanest burning coal in the world, I think, and also it's the best cooking coal, and so I'm for generating power plants and everything with coal, the best possible technology and also the best possible cleanest energy, and one of those is sitting right there in my district, and I'm for that, and to get more and prove that we can do it in a way that would benefit not only the environment but the people who in the lower the cost of energy, and also we can export that product, and so and that's what I really want to get down to is when I ask this question, I don't see any need to close coal fire. We just need to improve the environmental conditions if the federal government would help pay for it.
Good comment. Chair Vasquez, you have a question?
A few minutes ago, microgrids were mentioned. Next week, Tuesday, February 17th, we're going to have two presentations. They will probably discuss microgrids, and one of the presentations will be from the Alaska Power Association, and the second one will be from the Alaska Energy Authority. So microgrids will be discussed, I'm sure, in at least one, if not two, of those presentations next week, next Tuesday. I'm pretty sure, but we can confirm that.
Okay, is there any other questions of the presenters? Okay, hearing none, we'll thank you, and we'll open it up to public testimony in the hearing room. If anyone wishes to testify, please come forward. State your name for the record. Seeing and hearing none, we'll go to the off-net or the LIOs. We have no one signed up at the LIOs. We'll hold the bill and keep the public hearing open till the 17th, but the schedule will be finalized, of course, at the end of the week for next week. Mm-hmm. We will be working on a CS to take care of some of the concerns, working with the sponsor on that, and you'll have a work draft at least a day ahead of time sent out electronically to you for consideration with that. So is there any other comment of the committee on HJR 8 before we hold that till next week? Reptile Rico.
I want to thank the committee so much for advancing this so quickly and getting it out here and the discussion. I appreciate your participation, and we welcome anything that you can bring to us to add to this. And I apologize for emptying the room. Thank you.
Yeah, if members of the committee have anything they want to recommend as an amendment, I think for process-wise, work with the sponsor, and then they'll bring that forward. And Rep. Vasquez?
I don't have a particular amendment at this point in time. We will have other parties, I think, looking this over and making comments. Okay. But I have to say, this is so important. I mean, sometimes the biggest issues for our future, for our economy, for our well-being are sometimes just simply overlooked. But energy, reliable and affordable energy is so critical to the well-being of our citizens in the state and for future economic well-being and economic diversification. It's just absolutely critical. So unfortunately, people sometimes don't see the big issues, the white elephant in the room that everybody seems to ignore. But energy is this, I guess we all need to familiarize ourselves with this document that was presented, the energy market impacts of recent federal regulations on the electric power sector. Who was this, Representative Tallarico, who was Energy Ventures Analysis?
Yeah.
The Washington area.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. We got Representative Wool and Representative Nayak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. It says online, mm-hmm. page 2, I guess, whereas the loss of other traditional electrical generation methods may cause natural gas plants to be overused or used in ways that exceed their engineered design. A couple questions. What is traditional electrical generation? Is natural gas a traditional generation? And is there, have they been shown to be exceeding their engineered design?
Mr. Tallarico, you want to take a jump on that?
Yeah, I can. Yeah. Coal-fired generation has been around, in particularly in the interior Alaska, for an incredible amount of years. One of the generators in the Aurora Energy Power Plant is pre-World War II generator, coal-fired. And I guess my particulars on that would be of a more traditional long-term thing than natural gas. In fact, I don't know that we're developing, we even have any natural gas generation, particularly in the interior currently. We have NAFTA, and which is reasonably new to us in the interior, and of course diesel-fired. I think likely, in particular in the interior, say, for example, that we did close coal down and we shut down 25 megawatts of daily production in the Healy area and another over 20 megawatts right in the Fairbanks area. That impact on our grid would either require us to bring in more through the intertie, which isn't available to us right now because of the lack of carrying capacity, or try and develop of 120 megawatts of generation, which is running out in North Pole, to try and make up another 40 to 45 megawatts, which I don't even think is doable, actually. I think you'd be running at maximum capacity and you still wouldn't be able to energize the grid appropriately. So that's probably where we came from that. But we are certainly more than willing to work on this language. If it's going to need some adjustments, and we'd be more than happy to entertain any thoughts that anybody has to, remove that. Additional language is welcome as well.
Okay.
Follow up.
Would the improvement of the grid change this supposing that Intertie was strengthened or the bottlenecks were decreased. So would the improvement of the grid change the priority here? And yeah, I guess that's my question.
Rep. Tallarico.
Through the chair. I think improvement of the grid is going to be critical to us in the future so that we can continue to develop our economy. The big question in my mind is then turns into affordability. And what's the more stable market? How much stability is available via natural gas production or other productions as compared to potential coal-fired plants? And I'm such a man of simple terms that I'll put it in as simple terms as I can. It's at least appeared to me in a portion of my adult life that oil and petroleum products don't have the stability. I think marketing coal is kind of like marketing groceries. And, you know, you get them on the shelf and you have a long, long period of where you may have slow increases with inflation and things, but it's always appeared that that market stays a little more stable and everything. And it's always appeared to me that gas is the difference between, sometimes it's considered, or oil, I should say, sometimes it's considered a Ferrari and sometimes it's considered a Yugo. And it just depends. And it's so up and down and so unpredictable that occasionally I think part of our stability, part of our energy, or part of our solution is to have many, many diversified energy production things that we can tie together to provide stability in our energy costs so that we can continue to roll forward with our economy.
Thank you.
One last one.
Megic.
I'm the only member of the 28th legislative session in this committee. I'm so passionate about energy and energy costs, so I wanted to stay in this, and I'm glad to have, I got more ideas from you guys. The last two sessions we talked about biomass, natural gas, coal, hydro tidal, and geothermal, and we're talking about regional sources, and also the mini grid. In other parts of most parts of the state, there's different sources that are available. Like down here, there's a lot of biomass potential in along the rivers, river systems, like Yukon River and Cusco and all those other places. There's hydro,
in river turbines.
Yeah, in river turbines, and also in coal. There's several potential areas for coal generation and expanding the coal generation from Healy and other places, and geothermal. Those were available in different parts of the regions. So we should regionalize. We're trying to regionalize it because there's several sources of potential generation fuel for in the regions of the state. So I think we should continue to focus on what's available in the regions, like with that expansion of the coal along the road system, and I know we're working on that. Natural gas in Fairbanks and other areas, but we're hearing that it's going to cost a whole lot more to the customers. But we need to see what we can do to reduce those costs.
Thanks, Rep. Nagyak. We look forward to using your background and knowledge on these issues to help us move the ball forward here and implement some. Not talk about it, but how can we actually deliver low-cost energy to Alaskans? Madam Co-Chair.
I'm going to ask, when the Alaska Power Association presents next week, we'll ask them to present a map with the different regions and what they rely on. For example, in the Matsu, Anchorage, Kenai area, which contains about 70%, 60% of the state's population, they're heavily reliant on gas for production of energy. The rest is from Bradley Lake hydropower, but you know, southeast is diesel and hydro, and in other parts of the state it's something else. So it is estimated that we have, the state of Alaska has enough coal to power the whole United States for several hundred years. That's how much coal is estimated. Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing amount of coal, so maybe we should strive to be the premier research center for that. Get coal going.
Anyway. Good. I think Rep. Talrico wanted to yeah, another engagement, but is there anything else on this specific resolution? We're going to hold it and bring back your CS, get with the sponsor, and then we hope to get some, we'll work with the sponsor on the CS, get it back to you. You'll have it by early next week. And is there any other final comments on this resolution?
I think we're on the right track.
Okay, we're good.
I have one final comment.
Go ahead,
the last one. Speaking of traditional power generation, I believe in Fairbanks the first power plant up there was wood-fired.
Oh, yeah.
Just throw that out there.
Okay. All right.
It's called biomass.
So with that, we'll hold the public hearing open and hold that bill, and we'll calendar that for next week. We'll go back up the calendar to Nils Anderson. He's still online there. Mr. Anderson? You on the phone there, Nils? Nils?
Sorry, I'm still here.
Okay, appreciate it. Mr. Anderson, so if we had some, we're going to go around the committee and see if they had some follow-up questions. Representative Klayman, on your presentation.
Yeah, thank you, Glenn. Mr. Anderson, thank you for coming before the committee through the chair. I actually kind of had, in listening to the presentation, what I believe I've heard to summarize a little bit the lessons that it seems like the Institute of the North learned from these is that first we need to really develop a long-term plan. The second is that we, as the state, need to look fairly seriously at more of an investment in infrastructure as opposed to the production side. But one of the lessons is that the government body can be more involved in the infrastructure investment rather than the production side. And I guess the third message, which is the great challenge we're presented with this year and every year going forward, is the need to live within our means. And I'm just curious of if I'm accurately summarizing some of the lessons, how do we fit into the live within our means to that whole picture?
Thank you, Representative, through the chair. I should have had that as a final slide. That was a perfect summation. A few things. When it comes to the plan, I think that what I've heard most often is that the state's energy policy currently is aspirational. It's not directive. I think in talking with AEA and state agencies, certainly they've tried to operationalize the policy, but I think everyone could use further clarity on what exactly the legislature expects in terms of a strategy and implementation relative to the energy policy. And so in terms of comprehensive planning, strategic planning, other nations have been able to perhaps better prioritize how they move forward by going through that and doing that work up front. And my sense is that doesn't have to be as resource intensive as it doesn't have to come out of the state's budget in a significant degree. It could be done through house energy, through current processes to develop, formulate, and operationalize this energy policy. So I think that's one point. Yes, planning is essential, and I think with better planning, being strategic, being able to evaluate priorities, we'll see better decision-making or a different kind of decision-making that results in better returns to the state and public. Second, regarding infrastructure, all Arctic nations are similarly well-endowed with resources. And I think often Alaskans get caught up in how much we have without really talking as much about how much our citizens need and how to get it to them. And connecting those dots from supply to market is something we haven't done as well at, I don't think, in looking at other nations. We, at the 2013 Arctic Energy Summit, had hosted a panel of Alaska legislators who described Alaska's energy portfolio and were quite celebratory about what the state has in terms of a resource. And an Icelander from, I think, their one of their main power companies stood up and said, "You're crazy. You haven't invested in your people, and you haven't invested in your infrastructure, or your human and physical infrastructure." And those, for Iceland, were their two priorities, that with a people who were competent and globally competitive, they could solve for anything. And with the right infrastructure in place, they could step up into prosperity and economic development and deliver on the social services that their people required of them. Investment in human and physical infrastructure is very challenging, I understand, in an environment of fiscal constraint, which is, I think, the third point, living within your means. And I don't have... I don't know that anybody has right now kind of the magic bullet for that. But it really is a looking at the return that you want from those investments in a different kind of way. And moving from supply and technology and projects to, you know, how do we deliver affordable energy for our people? Iceland's president says that the promise of the Arctic should be clean energy. That's not Iceland's solution. Iceland's solution is affordable energy, and that's something that Arctic states should strive toward.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Another example,
Mr. Representative Nagy.
I'm sorry. Another example that was given last year was the because of the cheaper energy, they have service. They have service from all over the world. Located there, and they provide services for people all over the world from Iceland, and because of the geothermal power they have people are just using because servers are, you know, fuel intensive. I mean, they provide a lot of they need a lot of power for.
They have a lot of expertise in their industry.
Yeah, so that's 24 hours a day, and so they have unlimited supply of energy for those servers, and that's an example that was given last year.
Okay.
Okay, we'll go the co-chair of Vasquez.
I'll remind everyone that last week we had a presentation by Mr. Steve Klein, who suggested that perhaps the state may want to consider forming energy infrastructure fund that would put up $50 million from ADA funds available and raise an additional $200 million from the private sector. There are ways of partnering with the private sector to finance some of these projects. We just need to start thinking in those terms. May want to look at that presentation again.
Okay. Looks like that about wraps it up. Thank you, Mr. Anderson, for your well-thought-out presentation. And look forward to perhaps working with you on these issues, and hopefully members of our committee will be able to get to this energy summit in the end of September. So with that, we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, thank you. Our next meeting will continue on Thursday, February 5th. And Madam Co-Chair, do you want to briefly go over the agenda, or we'll...
I think that's...
It says published, so
yeah.
We're good.
Yeah. The following week, we have, on February 17th, a presentation by the Alaska Power Authority and the Alaska Energy Authority. And on the 19th, we have ARTEC, a presentation by ARTEC and by Golden Valley Energy.
Excellent.
We have a short presentation this coming Thursday on alternative ways to look at building up the grid.
Okay, with that, we'll adjourn, and we'll see you next Thursday. This Thursday.